Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Amar Ayash. He's a leading authority on the gulls of North America, a regular contributor to birding journals and magazines. He's also the host of the website anythinglaris.com, and we're talking about his mammoth new guide, The Gull Guide, North America. Amar, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mark.
Is this, when it says North America, am I to assume there's going to be other regional guides of gulls in this series?
You know, I'm not sure. And the reason why we inserted North America is because we didn't want to mislead the audience to think it was covering the entire globe.
Although, there have been so many vagrant gull species that have visited North America, and especially you're fairly up to date in this book. It's astounding the number of vagrants that have shown up here.
Yeah, we went all the way out to the last two species to be added to the ABA area, and that was Pallas's gull and gray gull. So I was down to the wire, like literally submitting my manuscript and getting in the gray gull appendix.
Do you have any bets on what the next vagrant species new to North America will appear?
For like the last two, three decades, people have guessed it would be Mediterranean gull.
Yeah, yeah.
It just never happened, strangely. So I'm thinking it could be Caspian gull or Odd One's gull. Odd One's gull.
Oh, yeah. I love Odd One's gulls. Yeah, I've seen them in Europe. I've seen them in Spain.
They've made it to Central America already. And there's no telling how long before they get here.
Then that's my bet, too, because if they've made it to Central America, it's just a hop, skip, and a jump up to North America.
Absolutely.
I got to talk to you about putting together a guide like this. Whenever I interview a person who's written a guide, I always think it's like one of the rings of hell trying to put together a book like this. Am I right?
You know, I mean, just it's the challenge is multidimensional. For one, nobody knows how to write a field guide unless you've done three or four of these things. First attempt at this, it's like, okay, where do you begin? And then, you know, with gulls, there's all the age groups that you have to factor in and all the hybrids that you have to cover. And so,
and I bet you they gave you a page limitation too.
Yeah, there was, and I went about 150 pages over, which was very nice of them to let me have the whole 150.
So this is your first guide?
First guide.
Wow, more power to you.
Thank you.
For people who don't know, putting together a guide that is all the identification, all the information of the appearance, and then as Mara mentioned, all the things with gulls with their plumages and molts, it's a mammoth task. I mean, you could have started with something simple like the chickadees of North America or something like that. But you went right for the meat and potatoes of the toughest, I would say the toughest group of birds in North America to identify.
Yeah, I went big. They're my favorite, and I wanted a book that anybody who has a real genuine interest in gulls would find of value for years to come, and so beginner all the way to advanced birder.
Yeah. Now, this is, to be fair, this is not the kind of guide you would bring out into the field in your back jean pocket, because this looks to me like the kind of guide that you take a photograph of an odd gull, you bring it back home, you get it up on the screen, and then you have to pour over all the information.
Yeah, I generally agree with that. It's a book you go to and work with when you have some problems. But strangely, just yesterday, a friend of mine from Antarctica posted a photo of him holding the book in Antarctica to help him with kelp gull identification.
Oh, God.
And then I was on the Illinois-Wisconsin lakefront yesterday with single-digit temperatures, and I ran into two birders who had the book with them, one in their bag and one in the car, and I just
I can see the car, but this is a hefty guide, and trying to lug it around to all the places where gulls appear just sort of seems weird. Now we should talk for general people who are non-birders in the audience. Gulls, as you mentioned in the book, are a real evolutionary success story in the world. Explain why.
Yeah, you know, they're generalists and they're opportunistic and they're able to thrive not just in natural settings, but also anywhere where we've had some influence, whether it be industrial areas, the way we fish, the way we farm. They're able to take to our presence, and they seem to adapt very well, regardless of the situation.
I guess an easier question to ask is, where aren't gulls found in the world?
Yeah, there's a few niches where they're still not really thriving. The Indonesian archipelago, for some reason, has more terns and very few gulls. Mountainous regions, except in the Arctic, they are found on seasides and cliffs. But overall, mountainous, high mountains, and I would say jungles for the most part.
But other than that, the Arctic, the Antarctic, there are gulls everywhere.
Yeah, they're widespread all around the globe. Laris, being the largest genus, is found worldwide.
And the thing is that even though you think there may be just one type of gull where you live, I'm in a county in Massachusetts. We're landlocked. We're right in the center of the county. You'd be surprised the list of gulls that of species that have appeared in this area. It's amazing.
Pretty incredible. Yeah, they do turn up just about anywhere, don't they?
Yeah, and not only that, with increased birders looking and knowledgeable birders looking, we're starting to find out that some bird, some gull species that were thought to be like never appear in the county are almost yearly, and that's like laughing gull, which is a coastal species that's common. But now inland, like one or two is starting to show up almost every year.
Interesting. Very interesting. Yeah, I hear that. I hear that almost everywhere. The more people looking, the more we're finding.
So how many species are there?
Depending on the taxonomy.
I was going to ask. It was sort of an unfair question.
Yeah. let's say 50-ish is a safe number.
Okay.
50.
Explain why identification, that gulls present the greatest field problems of any other group of birds.
There's just a lot of overlap from species to species. And then when you consider the subadult plumages, some of those Laris species taking 4 to 5 years to become adult-like, in those subadult plumages, you'll find an immense amount of variation where you can have a sample of 20 first-cycle birds of American herring gull, and 10 of them look completely different than the other 10. And so that type of variation is really hard for people to learn. It certainly can't be learned from a general field guide, but it's stuff you get around to getting comfortable with the more you watch them. But the amount of variation, the subadult plumages, and then add to it sometimes hybridization.
Oh, God.
And you have a few layers to peel.
Some of the variation, and you pictured these in your guide, are really odd. For instance, on page 56, there's a soiled glaucous gull, and it looks like literally the negative print of what a glaucous gull would look like.
That's the thing about gulls. They get themselves in so many messes, and they're so widespread and out in the open that you notice these things that you wouldn't otherwise notice maybe on a chestnut-sided warbler or something. They're just out there in the open for us to kind of observe and take in.
Now, have digital cameras really changed the whole sort of process of identification of gulls?
Oh, they have. They have, certainly. We have individual birds now that we can recognize across state lines, birds that come back. Yeah, it's incredible. We have an Iceland gull here in northern Illinois that without really good photos, you wouldn't be able to pin this thing to subspecies. And yesterday we got incredible shots of this thing, better than having it in the hand.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah, I'm looking at some of the gear some of these younger birders are carrying around, and I'm just like, wow.
Well, I know. It's funny because I'm much older birder. And now it looks like the camera is actually the major piece of equipment, not necessarily the binoculars.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Shoot first, ask questions later.
Right, exactly right.
The attitude. Yeah, certainly.
Now, we were talking about molting. Explain what molting means and why it just complicates things.
Well, molt is just simply the growth of new feathers. So old feathers have to be replaced. And when gulls and birds in general are molting, or when they're in high molt, usually in the breeding season and after the breeding season, they can look really ratty and uncharacteristic of what, you know, your field guides typically include, these really nice, pristine plates. But in the summer months here in the northern hemisphere, most of our gulls are in high molt, and so that adds to the complication of identification. But it is also fascinating if you think about all the facets of bird study, song, migration, nesting. Molt is one of those that's probably the least appreciated and the least studied by most people.
Well, you sort of have to get into it. I mean, you have to make it. It's not going to be that easy to learn. Confess that. And it's a learning curve. I mean, you're going to start out, and then the more you learn, you know, the more you still have to learn. But, you know, just sort of accept it. But it's not like warblers, you know, that you may have just two variable or three variable plumages. But gulls are really complicated. And some of them are two-year gulls, three-year gulls, and four-year gulls. And explain what that means.
Yeah, so, you know, like you mentioned, a passerine hatches in June. 10, 11 months later, it appears adult-like. It has this adult plumage. Whereas in gulls and other groups of birds, like bald eagles, and I can think of albatrosses maybe, we have birds that take 2 years to become adult-like, others that take 3 years, and the extreme, 4 to 5 years. And so the longer a species takes to become adult-like, the more variation we find in their plumages. So that's a fascinating part. And people who are obsessed with gulls usually love this sort of thing. The fact that they have four different age groups to look through is like seeing four different taxa to them.
I know, but there are times when larophiles really sound like Trekkies. You know, it's like they're really into the minutia. And I think that really freaks a lot of people out.
Yeah.
Are you one of those people?
I'm a member of that club.
I knew that. You had to be to do this book.
Yeah, it's you know, if there's any group of birds that deserves that kind of hair splitting, it's gulls, because we're able to. They're out in the open and they're right there in your face and allow you to see these things.
I know, that's the great thing about gulls versus sparrows. First of all, the large. Second of all, oftentimes they're in things like parking lots or dumps, and they don't mind an approach. And so you can get good looks at them, and you can get photographs. Is your recommendation to photograph first and then use the binoculars?
You know, I think it's a combination of both. I'm always torn between, like yesterday, the real feel was negative 12 degrees when I started my morning. And it was like, I have to make a decision here. I'm either going to hold these binoculars or hold a camera, but I'm not going to do both. And so I went with the camera yesterday.
Yeah. And there are birders, though, who just can't do gulls. You write about this in the book. There are birders that just sort of, it's like they've reached some kind of line in the sand. And you give a great example. I think, where were you, in Nantucket or something, or someplace on an East Coast beach? And there was a gull down the beach, and this prominent birder, who will remain nameless, identified it as a blackback gull. And you were the kind of person that went, well, wait a minute. And the gull eventually flew down closer to you guys, and it was a lesser blackback gull.
Yeah, I tell a few stories in the book just to kind of draw the reader closer and let them know that the struggle is not just you, it's everybody. Gulls are a problematic group. And, you know, take them for what they are and enjoy them. And it gives you something to do, at least depending on where you're located geographically. For me, it's something to do about 6-7 months of the year, and I don't know about you in Massachusetts, but anywhere you go, you're going to find them. It doesn't take long. You can get off an airplane and about 30 minutes from any airport in the world, go find some gulls.
Yeah, the great thing about ringbill gulls here in the Northeast is if there's a Denny's or a Burger King anywhere near, there's usually a couple of ringbill gulls hanging around.
Yeah, actually, we have this interesting bird here on the southeast side of Chicago. It's a ring-billed laughing gull hybrid.
Whoa. Is that a first? Because I've never heard of that.
They're increasing in the Great Lakes, not many.
Because they nest near each other, right?
Well, there's this fringe somewhere between the St. Lawrence River and the Atlantic where the two can come together. But it seems there's laughing gulls that get lost up here in the Great Lakes and ring-billed gull colonies, and that's the way we find these things. But this bird, incidentally, was found in a KFC parking lot perched on the Colonel himself, and so that he got that nickname, the Colonel. The best way to find these things, beaches, parking lots, amusement parks. Someone asked me once, what's the best way to begin gull watching? And I said, go to the beach and drop your lunch.
That's right. That's right. You'll see. But, you know, you do have to be careful because, you know, if you're there with binoculars, you look like some kind of weird pervert.
Certainly in the summer months, it's really awkward.
Now, the gulls have a propensity to stray, too. That's one of the other things. I was on the east coast of Australia. This is decades ago. And everybody was really excited there because there, I think, were two laughing gulls that appeared there. And I was on a pelagic that went out from Cairns or something like that. And everybody was looking for that laughing gull. We saw it, as a matter of fact. And that's really far to stray. Now, are these ship-assisted all the time or not?
The thought is they have to be, to some extent, ship-assisted. Maybe not across the entire journey, but for parts of it, I can't see it not happening. Laughing Gull and Franklin's, actually, those two are likely to turn up just about anywhere in the world, and they've probably strayed more than any other gull.
Well, two of the species that are in the book, in your book, the gray-hooded gull and Belcher's gull, the first thing I thought of is those have to be ship-assisted.
Yeah, you know, who knows? But
so what do you do in a case like, you can't tell and you can't prove it, so is it just in a gray area?
Yeah, you know, there's always that question mark and an asterisk with those birds, but overall, like, if there's no clear evidence of ship assistance, the gulls are powerful flyers, and we have no doubt they can make it across an ocean. There's no question, there's no problem accepting those birds that make it here, ship assisted or not.
You also, and I did not know this, is that gulls are also kept in avian collections.
Yeah, there was a guy.
I never knew that.
In Florida. Yeah, who I, you know, it's given me some ideas, but I won't say any more about that.
Well, I'm really used to it in waterfowl cases, because in waterfowl cases, you have no idea. I mean, I remember reading a list. I was on the Avian Records Committee here the first year it started, and the person from the Fish and Wildlife brought in the record of one person who kept species of waterfowl, and it included things like Steller's eider. And I was like, oh, my God, how can we ever? And the person also did not clip the wings of the bird. So, you know, it's like, yeah, you have no idea. Now, we're going to run out of time, and I got to talk to you about taxonomy.
Uh-huh.
Is it my imagination, or is gull taxonomy just chaos? Especially for things
chaos.
Like the herring gull complex.
Yeah, we have northern taxa around the Arctic Circle that genetically are very difficult to distinguish genetically. And so if you abide by the phylogenetic species concept, you might say, well, why aren't these all one species? They're so genetically similar. There is some messy taxonomy with some of the large Laris species, but those found around the equator, mid-latitude birds, their DNA seems to be sorted out overall. It's more the Arctic species.
Well, especially in your book, you talk about the Iceland gull complex, and you talked about the Iceland gull before. So the gull that you were seeing the other day, was that an Iceland gull or a Kumlian's gull?
So this is one of the best candidates we've had for nominate Lochoides, the one that breeds in Greenland and winters off of the North Atlantic. But yeah, we don't think it's Kumlian's, but who knows, really, because Kumlian's can overlap with nominate in many ways.
Yeah, I trust me, I know these issues.
Yeah, you know, here on the Western Great Lakes, it's probably the best place in the world to see all these different phenotypes. We get just straight Thayers and we get a good number of coumarins. And occasionally we'll get this pale thing that looks like nominate Iceland gall, which we've had here for now the last 10 days or so.
I have to say, from a birder's point of view, though, it's always cheery to see an Iceland gull, no matter what subspecies or type, because it's a cool-looking gull. I mean, instead of having the black on the outer primaries, it may have some black or gray, or it may be pure white, and it just looks beautiful. And here's this visitor from the Arctic down in front of you. I think it's amazing.
Oh, you're absolutely right. We were at a landfill doing a CBC outside of Philadelphia last month, and every time we put one in the scope, the response, no matter who was looking at this bird, the response was always, nice. Yeah, they just are beautiful birds.
They are. However, not as beautiful as an ivory gull or a Ross's gull.
Yeah, those two take the cake. And that's the juxtaposition that we have with these gulls. You have these small, nimble, tern-like gulls that are just incredibly beautiful, and then you have these large terrestrial belligerent large Laris species. So it's an interesting mix that you have in this group of birds.
Well, Bonaparte's gulls, which we get as a migrant both spring and fall inland, not common, it's uncommon, but at Wachusett Reservoir here we watch out for them all the time, and that has a real tern-like flight too. And it's sort of cool because if you see it in its breeding plumage, it's got a black hood.
Yeah, it's a strange one. They're skilled aerialists.
Yeah.
They have these raspy voices, and it's, incidentally, the only gull in the world that has to nest in trees. They prefer trees over anything else.
Fascinating. What's your favorite gull to look at? Not necessarily it's the rarest gull, but what's your favorite gull to just watch?
Yeah, I have a couple, but Iceland is up there, but I think Franklin's gull remains my favorite. Yeah, Franklin.
I had seen Franklin's as a stray before, but I was in Wyoming in the summer when there was a passage of Franklin's gulls through the interior, and that was really special to see.
Yeah, they are a unique species. That's our second longest migrating gull here in North America, and there's just so many fascinating things about them. They don't kleptoparasitize. They don't engage in cannibalism or siblicide. They actually adopt other Franklin's gulls that are in distress. They're really neat birds, and they have these two complete molts every year. It's our only gull that does that in North America.
They migrate as far south as what, southern Central America?
They go right through the interior from the prairie provinces down through Central America, and they end up off the coasts of Peru and Chile, and they feed in the rich waters of the Humboldt Current over the non-breeding season.
Are there any gull species that are endangered?
Well, some people suggest ivory gull is probably endangered.
But it's tough to tell.
It's just so hard to tell when we don't have a good handle on a number of ivory gulls to begin with. So how do you know something is endangered when you don't have the entire breeding population accounted for?
I know. I mean, for people who are listening, they breed up in the high Arctic, right?
They do. They do.
So how do you figure out what the population is?
Right. You go off of extrapolations made by people who've done surveys out there. And it's just really difficult to have a good census of ivory gulls and Ross's gulls and even the Iceland gulls. It's just it's not easy research, and it's cost prohibitive most of the time. People who go up there might get a season or two, maybe three seasons of research, and then it's over.
And some gulls have gone through name changes. I just realized, and for some reason I didn't know this, the Mew gull is now short-billed gull.
Yeah, there was a few years ago, not too long ago, I think 2019, it was split from the old world common gull.
Right.
And it was named short-billed gull, which is actually an old name of it.
What about Kamchatka gull?
Yeah, Kamchatka gull is this subspecies of the European common gull. It's found in, Kamchatka and northern Russia. And in many ways, they're this kind of mid phenotype that has attributes that resemble our short-billed gull and has attributes that resemble common gull in Europe. It's a really interesting bird. And ironically, there's a number of records of them in the last 15 years off the Atlantic over where you're at, actually.
Yeah, they've shown up here. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's very strange. And then there's very few records of them in the West, which means if they are there, they're probably being overlooked as short-billed gulls.
Is the feeling that they're traveling over the Arctic Circle and then down in the Northeast? Because, I mean, they're showing up almost every year somewhere around in the Northeast.
Yeah, there's one in Connecticut right now and one, I believe, in, I want to say Maine, perhaps, or maybe Massachusetts. Yeah. Massachusetts. Yeah, so that's the thought right now, that them, along with things like slatyback gulls, are probably going over Arctic Canada and drifting southeast.
Yeah, slatybacks are showing up every once in a while here, too.
Yeah, they are. That species has exploded within its range, and so there's no surprise there to see them spilling over into North America.
We got to stop talking about gulls because we could go on for hours. My guest tonight is Havar Ayash. He's a leading authority on the gulls of North America and a regular contributor to birding journals and magazines. He's also the host of the website anythinglaris.com. And we're talking about his new book. It is really an amazing accomplishment that you got this done, man. The Gull Guide, North America. Amar, it's been a real pleasure.
Hey, thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.